Welcome to Dollars and Cents, Creating Your Fulfilled Life with Nicole Romito from Private Vista. In this podcast, we draw from years of experience as well as guest specialists to help you create the life you imagine. Join us in this journey as we enlighten and empower you to align your lifestyle to help you achieve your goals with a clear picture of your future. Now, let's get to the show.
Hello, and welcome to the Dollars and Cents podcast with Nicole Romito. Nicole, really nice to see you again. I hope you're well.
I'm doing great, Bill. I hope the same goes for you.
Yeah, it's been a little crazy, around too many grandkids, sharing their grandkid germs, but other than that, it all's good.
Yes, they are. They can be little petri dishes. So.
Yeah, they can be, by golly. So what have we got today?
Yeah, I was going to say, let's jump right in because we're going to have an action-packed episode. I'm super excited. This is the second episode in our series that is going to be focused on business owners who are thinking of or in the process of selling their business. I just want to say to our listeners, if you haven't had a chance to listen to the first episode with George Kay, please check it out. He and I discussed how to prepare to sell your business from the psychological and emotional perspective. And the common evolution for that is I have in studio with me today, Deanna Salo and Eric Vanderplug, and we're going to discuss the legal and tax and financial considerations when either you're preparing to sell your business or maybe you're at the onset of that process. So first of all, I'd like to say welcome in to Deanna and Eric.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Yes.
Good morning.
So I'm really appreciate you guys taking time out of your busy schedules to have this discussion with me. And I know our listeners are going to very much benefit from the wisdom and tips and stories that you guys will share today.
Great.
So before we get into our topic at hand, I'm going to give a little brief bio for our listeners on both of my guests today. So first, I'm going to introduce Deanna Salo. She is a Cray Kaiser principal and has been with them in that capacity since 2001, and she's been their managing principal since 2021. Deanna executes assurance, strategic, and tax planning services across the client portfolio. For closely held and family-owned businesses, she focuses on the value she can bring to the family and owners. Using her technical and creative talents, she also performs M&A engagements for both the buyer and seller sides. She leads her firm's relationship with the Entrepreneur and Family Business Council at DePaul University. And she is also the past chair of the Strategic Partner Committee there and presently serves on the Finance Committee and Curriculum Committee. Given her investment in the success of family-owned businesses, it should come as no surprise that members of the organization practically have Deanna on speed dial. I know, as do I.
Thank you.
No, thank you. Also joining us, as I mentioned, Eric Vanderplug. He's a partner at Burke, Warren, McKay, and Saratella PC. He's a member of the firm's litigation, automotive franchise, and consumer financial services litigation practice groups. He started his career as a litigator and therefore has handled an array of commercial matters in both state and federal court, ranging from simple contract disputes to complex commercial and business disputes. While he is focused on those specific practice areas, today he's going to share his broader experience in working with small and mid-sized businesses in a variety of industries. And he also regularly advises clients on selling and acquiring businesses. And as I said, that's where he's going to be able to share his knowledge and experience with us today. How the three of us know each other, as we referenced through Deanna's intro, is the EFBC, which is the Entrepreneur and Family Business Council. And that's an organization that exists to educate and empower the people of family and entrepreneurial businesses through impactful programs and a unique community of peer support. So I know all of us enjoy working together in that context. Again, I'm super excited to have you guys here today. I know we've got a lot to get to. So before we jump into our topic at hand, we do want to remind our listeners that while we are going to be discussing topics that involve legal and financial matters, In no ways are we giving legal, financial, tax advice. We're here to talk really anecdotally, to share experiences and things that you may want to consider. But we always recommend that you talk with your personal legal, financial, and tax advisors to see what is the best path for you based on your individual situation. With that was kind of just a lot to get out to our listeners. Why don't we kind of start off with how we have seen attorneys and financial professionals working together? And maybe we can talk about how do you start to put the team together at the beginning of the process? So I'm going to put it out there. I don't know if Deanna or Eric would like to kick us off with our conversation on that topic.
I'll start first. Typically in our relationships with our clients, there are multiple conversations that lead us to, well, maybe it's time to sell. And really, I believe it always starts with getting your financial warehouse in check, meaning getting your internal controls, getting your processes documented, whether we're doing as your outside CPA firm and a compilation, a review, or a financial audit. Those events, those engagements typically lead to your outside CPA assisting you with getting your financial warehouse in check. Because the first things that are usually disclosed, and we'll talk about a little bit of that later, is the financials, any buyer or set target that you're going to be perhaps going through this journey. So from the financial side of it, it's really looking at where are we at? Where have we gone? What do the last 5 to 7 years look like? And then as we start talking about the timing of an event, of a transaction, it's also key to understand, do you have the proper counsel in check, the legal counsel? Because from the onset of these discussions, we need to make sure that agreements are in good order, your corporate records are in good order, because these are likely part of the list of due diligence that any buyer would want to see to make sure that, you know, not only is the company a great operating entity, but its structure and there's four legs to the stool, if you will, that there's stability and there's an awareness of what the corporate structure is. And your attorney takes a big part in that corporate structure and making sure your documentation is in good order.
Yeah, Nicole and Deanna, I think Deanna is absolutely right from the lawyer's perspective. You know, a lot of times if a client comes to me and they're interested in selling their business and we sit down, we start talking about it, if they haven't already talked to their financial advisor and their tax planner about it, I'm usually like, go back and talk to them first and then come back to me and let's talk about where we go from here. Because if it doesn't make sense from a strategic standpoint, if it's not the right time for the business, if it's not the right time for the equity holders, then, you know, we could spend a lot of time hypothetically talking about what the transaction looks like, how we might structure it, what the legal implications are, without really going anywhere. From my perspective as the lawyer, I really think that the discussion for a lot of sellers will start with going back to their financial advisors, talking about what is this? Is it the right time for me? What are the tax implications look like? Absolutely. What else might I have going on in terms of the time of year of where we are? Or maybe what does the last 3 years look like for me? 5 years? What are the next 3 years look like? Because there may be better times to sell the business, or this might be really the right time. And that should be driving the conversation.
Yeah, transition preparation readiness is a really important part of getting ready. If you're a sole owner and you're the answer, the bee's knees to making the decision, that's one thing. But if you do have an ownership group, ownership needs to be starting to talk about this, because different members of the family, different members of the ownership could have a different perspective of where they're at in their own personal timeline of doing a transaction. So sometimes it might be you need to do some corporate reorganization and ownership first to get some readiness to it if some people want to go out sooner than later. But it is it's a conversation at a family meeting or a board meeting, or, you know, certainly not at the Thanksgiving or Christmas dining room table that most conversations happen with in small business. But at the same time, those discussions are really important to get, as George K. noted, the emotional readiness and now the transactional readiness when you start talking to your advisors.
Yeah, I agree. And just to add on, I think also understanding as you have your team together, looking at kind of knowing your number for most, if not all business owners, they look at their business, you know, as another child, and they've put a lot of time and love and energy and blood, sweat, and tears into it. And so they may say, I want or need to get top dollar. But, and while that's maybe not necessarily a bad thing by looking at it in the context of what are they moving to and what are they trying to do? What do they need to get out in this liquidity event in order to be able to continue to live life how they want? That number could be lower, or it could look different than they're thinking of just from a sales perspective. And I know with us work, the three of us working together with clients, is sometimes that allows them to be able to move through the process where they might say, okay, this is the number I need to get to make sure myself and my loved ones are going to be able to continue to live life without worry, or, you know, knowing that we're still on a good trajectory. But then Eric and Dee, you guys might say, great, looking out at the marketplace or looking at your unique industry or unique niche in the industry, you may only need X, but we think you can get Y.
Right.
I think on the other side of that too, the tough love conversations, you know, that I have with clients is, you know, what you need to survive your lifestyle, your family, generational lifestyle may not be the value of the business. So we really do need to take a hard look at where the company is and is going. Owners sometimes forget that they have, in fact, taken value out of the business as much as they've even put into the business in terms of distributions and compensation. And there's no value to put on that intangible of blood, sweat, and tears. Never, ever. True. At the same time, the value isn't on that napkin that you slide across the cocktail table to say, this is the value that I need. We can always work to that end and understand that what that is, but that may not always dictate what the value may be in the marketplace. You know, fair market value is what the buyer and seller can agree upon, which may not be what somebody thinks that their company is worth.
Yeah, I think one of the really important things to keep in mind from a seller's perspective is a lot of times they're not the ones that are driving the decision to sell, right? A lot of times a seller is going to be in a position to sell because either they're close to retirement and they kind of have to sell, right? To basically wind down, or they no longer want to do what they're doing. But a lot of times it's because they've been approached from a buyer, or there's so much activity in the market in terms of acquisitions that it's really the buyer that is approaching the seller and saying, hey, look, I like your business. I think you've got a great concept. Let's talk. And so for a lot of times, I think, you know, we find sellers who are in positions of saying, I'm surprised to be in this position. I didn't think I would be in the process of getting ready to sell my business a couple of years ago. And then there's always a question of, okay, someone's now come to you with an offer. Mm-hmm. Is it the right offer? If you really are interested in doing this, are there more offers that might be out there that we should be exploring? And what is that exploratory phase look like, and how do we go about it? And so I think in terms of the objectives, the value of the business, in terms of how that's going to affect the seller later on, that those are important considerations. But of course, it's also like, what does the market look like right now? And is this really an offer you should be considering?
Yeah, that's a great point, Eric. And maybe what we can transition to now is talking about, you know, if you are approached by a seller, maybe you weren't actively looking, but someone cold called you, how would you want to look at maybe what other offers are out there or could be out there? And then how are you guys preparing your clients for kind of some of the key pieces that are going to be involved when they're at the beginning of this process?
Yeah. In terms of if they get that parachute, I always call it that somebody parachutes into your life and says, hey, we love your company. We've heard about it. We'd like to demographically come into your area. We have this product line. You have these product lines. You know, there's some synergy with respect to the companies. That's fantastic. But I would also say that having more than one, you know, person courting your firm, courting your company is kind of a best practice. And so where I've seen some of our clients go to is that when they get that parachute note that says, hey, we'd like to talk to you, it start having those conversations. And what they'll do is they may talk to customers, they may talk to vendors, because obviously these are people the closest to you. Not to say you want to share with everybody, hey, we're for sale, you know, I've got this offer, you know, you still need to have some level of confidentiality. But even just dinners and some meetings and some conversations with the executive teams at some of your customers and vendors, that could also trigger some alignment with respect to them being one of your customers or vendors also being interested in purchasing your company too. So those that are closest to you that you've worked with for a really long time, they know you. They know your cycles, whether it's your purchasing or they know your cycles because of how much they've consumed from you. It's very interesting to see both sides, customers and vendors, being a great opportunity for businesses to consider selling to.
from my perspective, kind of where you start to actually look at it from the legal perspective too, because key relationships are important from the standpoint of, is there value here? Is this worth doing? There's also legal concerns that start to arise when you start talking about what are my relationships with vendors, with customers, with key providers, with lenders potentially. Can I even sell my business? Can I even enter into an agreement with my business or to sell my business without talking to these folks first and potentially either getting some kind of consent or making sure that we're at least covered so that we're not in violation of some kind of covenant that they have? So this is, I think once you get to the point where you're kind of like, hey, there's something on the table, something, someone's approached me or I'm ready to explore this. I think that's where you do have to kind of start getting your lawyer involved too, to start looking at what do we have in place and what are our rights and obligations. And I think a lot of times sellers skip over this part and they go straight to, they're in an NDA, they signed a non-binding LOI. And of course, if it says non-binding, it must be non-binding. And that's not always the case as well. But you know, now when you've gotten to the point where you're starting to contract and you've kind of made commitments to people, you really have to be careful of those other legal relationships you have.
The excitement around being seen as a valued asset to somebody else, owners get super excited and even giddy, if you will. And that giddiness can lead to, you know, sharing information too soon. I always say, don't let the horse out of the barn. You know, you need to talk to counsel to make sure you've got a solid non-disclosure agreement and NDA in place before you start sending any financial information. You know, there's a lot of comfort with respect to the people that a seller will talk with, especially somebody that's looking at them to buy and even the customers and vendors approach. So there's comfort there. This is not a comfortable process. And the more you can keep it to the brick and mortar, if you will, the better off you'll be. A buyer is not your best friend. They may become your best friend, but they're obviously looking at it from their perspective with their processes, their requirements in place. And you have to stay keen to you, what you need and what your requirements are, which is why counsel is so important on the NDA and not sharing financials or tax returns. I had an inquiry from a client that somebody was just going to want to talk to them and they wanted customer lists and vendor lists and employee lists. And I put a big timeout on the email and I said, absolutely, positively not. In friendly chatter at a dining room table to say our revenue is X and our profit margins are Y, you know, in just some candid and loose conversations, maybe, but do not start sending any of that information until that part is all really letter of intent after the LOI to get customer lists and vendor lists and employee lists. Typically, the initial package after an NDA is signed is the financial information and perhaps some even tax returns and maybe even some organizational structure clarification so that the buyer knows what the structure is of the target to determine what's the best acquisition model to continue the endeavor of the conversations.
It is fascinating where obviously we're talking with people who are intelligent, they've been successful in either founding or running or growing the business. But you really hit the nail on the head, Deanna, where when it comes down to, we're all still human beings, and it is exciting and flattering that someone else is looking at the probably what's the biggest asset in their lives to say, hey, I see value in that, and I would like to talk to you about buying that. It is really important that as our listeners are thinking about this, that you're talking to your team to make sure that you're not inadvertently or accidentally doing something that could harm you in the process. Or we've all had enough of these conversations to know that not every deal ends up going through for a whole host of reasons.
Right.
So you wouldn't want any confidential or proprietary information out there, especially if it's a competitor who is approaching you.
And Nicole, when you mentioned my bio, you mentioned that I started my career as a litigator, and that really is where I started my career. I've had the privilege of being able to move into more transactional work, but being a litigator and starting off as a litigator, I've seen enough deals go south to know kind of where some common issues come up. And one of the things that I think is a misconception that a lot of business owners have when they have other equity holders or other partners, even if they're small percentage holders, is that they control this decision to sell and that they can have these negotiations with a potential buyer. And maybe they're the president of the company or they own 85% of the stock or 95% of the stock, and they don't take into consideration, what do my own agreements say? What do my own corporate agreements say? Do I have a shareholders agreement? Am I in an LLC or a partnership? Do I have an operating agreement that restricts my ability to sell my business. You know, in a lot of states, the statutes that govern companies like LLCs in particular will require unanimous consent of the members to sell the assets of the company. And so if you have a member who's like, and of course, this is assuming there's no operating agreement in place that would say something different, which is true for some companies. But if you've got 99% of the equity interest in memberships and you've got a 1% member out there, they may have the right to totally blow up your sale. And you can get really far down the road talking with a potential buyer, maybe even making some commitments to them, disclosing some information that maybe you shouldn't have without thinking through those issues. So obviously, everybody wants to be in the driver's seat in these processes for good reason. But that is an early legal consideration that I think folks need to be working with their lawyer, talking with their business partners at the appropriate time, and making sure that they have buy-in from everybody whose consent would be required to even go down this path before you spend a bunch of money trying to do something you can't do, or worse, find yourself in litigation over whether or not, you know, you did something that you shouldn't have done.
Yeah, litigation with your own partner, right? Before you're even litigating with your potential buyer. So yeah, there is an order here that we're trying to, you know, share with you guys today, so that it's important to, you know, make sure in speaking with your advisors early, corporate documents, getting your house in order. We oftentimes recommend clients to get their data deck together, because if you're in fact not soliciting, but you've got multiple interested parties out there, you want them all to have the same information. So getting whatever that initial information together is, which is really financials and tax returns, maybe some corporate structure information on who the owners are and what the organizational chart might even look like. That's an important deck that you'll be sending out to every single potential buyer, so that everybody's got the same information and can make the same assessment, or you can at least be comparing apples to apples when you get potential LOIs back from these buyers.
I want to kind of circle back to something that Eric commented on, is even if you're the majority owner, as I mentioned at the offset of this, the way the three of us know is through the EFBC. So we work with a lot of closely held or family-owned businesses. And it's not uncommon where we've seen some of the owners maybe have transferred smaller minority interests, whether it's shares in the business or parts of the LLC shares, for estate planning purposes. And oftentimes it's usually to family members, but they could have involved a key person in the business. While we kind of hit upon that, you need to make sure, are they on board? How, you know, maybe do we want to talk about those family members going to be involved ongoing? When is the proper time to bring them into the conversation, and the timing of sharing information? Because I know that's a common situation that the three of us see with a lot of the clients we work with.
Yeah, the frequency of communication in an organization is what it is. They're not meeting on a concurrent basis, or I call them the doorway conversations. You know, people are just standing in each other's doorways talking about stuff. Right. It is an important process to have family meetings or business partner meetings at least every couple of months. So these things should be brought to the table as soon as they're known. Because if you are the majority owner and you're representing a leadership, and the roles and responsibilities you have as the president, CEO, whatever you are, general manager of the LLC, your role and responsibility is to share that information with the group. So whether you call a meeting, special meeting to order, whether you have those separate conversations, which is not recommended because everybody should be in the room, you know, everybody should be in the room. And I can say that 5 or 6 times, and sometimes not everybody's in the room, but in these kind of conversations, the readiness really needs to incorporate everybody in the room. Also knowing in that organizational chart, what are the owner's roles and responsibilities? Because sometimes you have family members who are not active in the company. You know, they received their shares from mom or dad 30 years ago when they've got a fractional ownership, and they pick up their K-1 or their tax distribution every year, and that's really all we hear from them. When you start going through these M&A considerations, they do need to be brought back into the fold. Maybe they're just a silent investor, not even physically in the business at all. And they too, as Eric mentioned before, have an opportunity to stay a transaction if they are not in agreement with it, if your operating agreement or your shareholder agreement says it so.
Right. And I know we're not here to talk about estate planning, but in some respect, these are all considerations that hopefully folks have thought through as part of their estate planning processes. Whenever you're gifting, if you're like the sole owner of a company and you're like, hey, I've got 5 kids or nieces and nephews and cousins or whoever, and I want to do a little gifting of equity, there are strategies that you should be putting in place as part of that that still give you the driver's seat of the company and control over those shares. Where you get into, and there are considerations for not doing that, right? If you want to have buy-in from some of those family members, if you want to eventually maybe transition some of the business to another generation, for example, maybe you do give them votes. Maybe you do give them a seat at the table because you want them to have that skin in the game, so to speak. Right. But, you know, in theory, if you're planning on selling your business in the near foreseeable future, but you're also going to be doing some gifting, you should be making sure that you have the necessary agreements, controls, limitations on those equity interests that you're gifting to allow you to still make the strategic decision that's the best for you and for the business, right? Which may ultimately be to sell it. So a lot of what we're talking about, avoiding who you speak with and who you talk with, those are hopefully considerations you had before you brought them into the business. But certainly there are things that revisit right. as you're getting ready to sell.
Hey, pardon the interruption. I know you are listening to Dollars and Cents, Creating Your Fulfilled Life with Nicole Romito, and we're happy you're here. If you have any questions, please head over to myprivatevista.com or the show notes to find out how to reach us. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, absolutely. We've talked a little bit about, you know, the team, kind of some of the things to consider where you're at the beginning of the process. We've talked a little bit about others who may be impacted. I think maybe for the rest of our time together, do we want to pivot to maybe like the due diligence process? I know George and I talked a lot about it's a marathon, not a sprint. He even highlighted, make sure you're in good physical shape because it is going to take, you might think, but I'm just sitting in my boardroom or I'm doing Zoom calls. What? I'm not on a treadmill negotiating my finer points. But as we all know, it is a lot of emotional weight and mental weight, which George and I talked about, but that does transition into the physical, kind of your physical impacts. And I know you guys know even better than I, like the due diligence process, it can be a slog. Deanna, do you want to lead us off? I know I love your saying about the three P's. Do you want to start us off with that?
Sure,
and then Eric, please chime in.
You know, the three P's is the people, the process, and the product. And you've got to have all of those things really readied before you get into this due diligence phase. So understanding who your key people are, understanding your organizational chart, the roles and responsibilities, maybe by title. You don't have to name Sally, Jack, and Brian that are, you know, those people, but actually what do they do in the organization in terms of the people? You know, your processes, whether it's your operational processes, your accounting and financial processes, really have to be in, I don't want to say good shape because that's a perspective. You need to understand and be able to explain to a third party what your processes are. Because if there's any question as to that doesn't sound right, or you don't have a control here, or there's no authorization model for something to happen there, then there's probably some risks, underlying risks of the business that might devalue your company. And then clearly your product. I mean, your product is what probably a third party knows of first and foremost. They either know your services or your product in the market space, and that's what brings them to you. But then they need to check under the hood and put the car up on the rack and take the wheels off and test everything, which is really the due diligence process. The rigor that you were talking about, Nicole, in terms of being physically and mentally ready, I think is very important. And one of the things I tell clients as they start this process, and I said, my number one recommendation to you is to keep your eyes on your business, because this is a huge distraction to your day-to-day.
That's a great point.
To all the things you have to do, because if you get derailed with this due diligence and the focus and attention and the hours and the commitment that you're going to have in the discussions and interaction of data, you have to still run your business. If you stop running your business or take your eyes off those metrics, your business could have some economic downturn that would devalue your transaction in the short term. Keeping your eyes on your business is probably my first and foremost recommendation as clients start this process, because it's going to get pretty foggy pretty fast. I actually have a client in due diligence from the signing of the LOI. I don't know how many hundreds of emails into the discussions already. So the buyer wants to do this due diligence in a very short amount of time, 45 days, 60 days, something that's pretty short. Mm-hmm. And that works well for you as the seller, because if there is an economic downturn, you want to continue the value as it presently stands. Sure. However, it could work against you, because if you're on a rolling ride uphill, meaning you're tracking really well, you may want a little bit more time to see how really great you're going to do this year, to perhaps add an earnout or some other type of financial consideration to your purchase price. So keeping your eyes on the business during this process is paramount.
From my perspective, from the seller's perspective, a lot of times in these transactions, due diligence is really the most amount of work. I mean, I think a lot of times sellers think, well, hey, I'm selling my business. All I need to do is sit back and let you can look at whatever you want to look at and just pay me when we're ready to go and take my business. But in reality, the expectation is on the seller in most contracts to provide, you know, information, which sometimes is described pretty broadly. And you have these broad categories of documents. And of course, the buyer, particularly because most arm's length sales that we're talking about of businesses are going to be asset sales, right? So the buyer wants to know, what am I getting? What's there? What do I have to look at? Am I going to be, whether they try to not do it or not, am I going to be taking on liabilities and what liabilities might be there? So I think, you know, the seller really is going to have to do a lot of the data gathering. And the one thing that we see frequently in a lot of sales, when clients come to us and they say, well, I don't want to tell my key management people that I'm doing this. I don't want them to get worried. I want them to know they're in good hands. The reality is that those are the people who are going to be doing and helping you do due diligence. You may not be able to do an effective job as a seller providing the level of diligence that the buyer may be expecting of you without the assistance of those folks. And so you do have to think about, can I do this? Can I go through with the sale without certain key employees knowing about it? And then what conversations do I need to have with them early in the process to make sure, one, I've got their buy-in on the process, and two, I've got their confidence? Because Deanna, you had a saying earlier about, you know, letting the cat out of the bag or something to that effect. I always say loose lips sink ships. And it's a little bit of one of those things of sometimes you get the wrong people who know about a deal before it's close to going through or being consummated. It can sink the whole thing. And then it can leave a seller with really not a lot of marketability.
The idea of letting your CFO, controller, internal accounting management, VP of finance, or whoever the title is, that person or that team definitely is. And that's not even in the, you know, perhaps the C-suite of executives, whether it's your sales managers, your sales team, or your GM of operations. Those are all the other fundamental people on the org chart that need to be part of this conversation. And there is a way to provide that information to them. Certainly, if they're your key team, they're likely understanding and knowing perhaps your desires to transact the business at some point in time. Right? They've already heard your story. They already understand your timeline. So you coming to them with an opportunity is not new news. It's just now current news. It's just, it's going to happen. And we're going to go through this process. And I need you all to stay confidential with respect to this. These are also key people that any buyer is also going to want employment agreements with.
Exactly.
So these folks, you know, should likely not lose their jobs. They're key people. They're likely going to be even more needed, desperately needed, as the transition happens to the new buyer. So creating the narrative around this is really important. We oftentimes help clients with that. When do I tell? How do I tell? Right. Oftentimes it is scripting at first, because the excitement, that bubbly giddiness that I talked about before, owners sometimes, you know, say too much, even to those executive members. I'm not talking about the other owners. That's the conversation that happens even before, you know, you're talking to your key executives. And those people need to understand your genuineness in wanting to make sure that these team members have a place on the other side of this transaction. No promises can be made, of course, but as the owner, I'm going to make sure that I'm your advocate in letting the buyer know how important you are to the process, to the profitability, and to the operations of the company. And therefore, you have a deal on the other side of this transaction.
I couldn't agree more. I know I've seen where some clients, they knew the number they needed to get, and we had, you know, worked with the tax and the legal to make sure it was all structured to the best advantage for them. So they were more concerned with their key people who, while they weren't blood related, they really were like family to them, because they had helped them build the company or been there 20, 30 years. And so I know my client was more concerned with, hey, I want to make sure like these five people are taken care of. And how do we talk to the potential buyer about that?
Yeah. Right. I think even that's a good point that needs to be in the letter of intent. Letters of intent, from my perspective, and I'm not the attorney here on the call, but the letter of intent is the framework by which the purchase agreement or whatever agreement's going to be had is the framework of it. So if there are key people in your organizations, you would like a bullet point in that LOI that says employment agreements will be constructed for key members of management. You know, at least just to say it, they're not committing to what the terms are, what the monies are, but that it's acknowledged that we understand you have key people and those people are going to have separate employment agreements executed. You know, there's a host of things that I think should be in the letter of intent. I saw one just yesterday that a client received from a private equity company. And it, from my perspective, it was missing so much. The generalities of an LOI, people think like, well, we just want to keep it kind of general and loose so that we can negotiate and kind of figure this out as we go. And I'm like, no, we want some specifics. As the numbers gal in terms of these agreements, I would like some specificity in terms of escrow requirements and the timeline to the release of the escrow. Certainly the purchase price, certainly the allocation of the purchase price, at least in generalities, to say we're going to agree to the allocation of the purchase price, net working capital requirements. The absence of anybody using the net working capital language in an LOI is missing. Like, we need to understand what the transaction is going to be. So there's a lot of things that need to go into that LOI before a seller even signs it to then start the timeline on actually having the due diligence done that we were talking about before.
All right. Well, I could sit here and talk with you guys all week and we still would not cover everything that we would want to. I'm going to say we're going to kind of wrap up here. Eric, is there anything else you wanted to add on to Dee's last comments or anything you just wanted to make sure that our listeners are aware of?
No, yeah, I think Deanne had it exactly right about the LOI. And sometimes we get LOIs that we haven't even been involved in. I mean, the clients put them together. They're like term sheets. And then all of a sudden they've signed them. And we're like, maybe
that
we can't.
Super fun.
Right. Maybe we can't do this. That's always fun to find out after you agree to an LOI with somebody. So, I mean, I think this goes back to the idea of getting your professionals involved early on in the process is key, particularly for those kind of pre-contracting steps, right? Your NDA, pre-contracting diligence, the LOI. A lot of times clients try to kind of wing this stuff because they want to save costs or they want to get to the end quickly, but it makes it so much easier if you've got the right folks in place early. And I totally agree. I mean, I think the LOI is an opportunity to get a lot of the work done before the parties are really kind of locked in. A lot of LOIs are non-binding. I think I said that earlier, but a lot of times they will have provisions in there regarding like maybe confidentiality or exclusivity of negotiations, which a lot of times are binding provisions. And so if you're a seller, you don't want to necessarily be locked into exclusive negotiations with a potential buyer for the next 60 days if it's a hot market, and then all of a sudden realize, you know what, I don't really like the terms that we agreed to in this LOI, because you don't really have a choice to necessarily, you may have to go forward with the deal at the end of the day, but you may have to wait till the expiration of that LOI before you can move on.
If I could just add to, you know, we talked about the numbers and what owners need, you know, their financial needs for short-term and long-term goals with the after-tax cash flow. And if a seller has an idea of what the market might bear, it's really one of the fundamental things we do for clients is get them their after-tax cash flow. We can do a pretty good estimate of what their after-tax cash flow considerations might be given X, Y, or Z purchase price, sale price. And so understanding that ahead of time, because sometimes people are pretty shocked about how much taxes are going to be coming out of this asset sale. There's ordinary and capital gains tax considerations, and people sometimes don't understand the difference, which is our jobs as the CPAs to explain those differences. So making sure you also have a good handle on the after-tax flow considerations, even in that early stages of NDA, and you're getting an idea of what people might bid you in the marketplace.
Sure.
Having some running of the numbers is an important step too.
I agree. And also being the other numbers gal in the studio here, I couldn't agree more. Again, we could and probably should do a whole nother episode just on the X's and O's on that part. I know we really just dipped our toe into the vast pool of knowledge and wisdom and experience all of us could share, but I do have to wrap up our episode today. So I do want to say thank you again to Deanna and Eric for sharing all your knowledge and time with our listeners. I think, as you guys know, as longtime listeners of the podcast, I wrap up every episode with a question for each of my guests. And that is, if you could live anywhere in the world, just pretend there's no time constraints or financial constraints, or you have to be in any certain place because of your firm or family or anything, where would it be and why?
I'll let Deanna take this one first.
I knew that was going to be the case.
Our family has, for probably over 10 years, vacationed in Cabo San Lucas, Mexico. And it's, you know, my husband's a deep sea fisherman, loves fishing, obviously the whale watching, the temperature is pristine, Wi-Fi is really good. So when you need to connect, you know, you're not in the middle of a forest or on the top of a mountain that you don't have technologies that we all still need, even if we're just in complete, you know, zoning out time.
Right. Yeah.
But it's one of my most favorite places. And the food and the people and is just a really awesome place to be. And I have just so many fond memories there. It could be someplace that I would, you know, love to have a place at or even stay at for longer terms than just a week or 10 days.
I think that sounds amazing.
That was a great answer. Now I want to change my answer to Cabo. Oh. But so for me, you know, I mean, it's such a hard question. I've always loved the American Southwest. I've always loved the nature, the serenity, the beauty of it. I could definitely see myself retiring there one day and enjoying myself. And you still have access to, you know, major U.S. cities and golf and all sorts of other things that are going on. So I think it would be a great place to live one day. But for me, it's the natural beauty. I think there's so much in this country in terms of nature and geology and history. And I think the Southwest is really well steeped in that. So that's where I would want to spend the rest of my time.
I love it. Well, my answer always changes as well as I hear everyone else's great answers. So, all right. Well, thanks again. If any of our listeners would like to get in contact with either of you, what's the best way to do so? So Deanna, do you want to share your contact info first?
Sure. Best is to just look at our website, www.craykaiser.com, and go to people, and I'm there, my email, my telephone number. In today's world, we're always on, so we'd be happy to hear from anybody if they need some assistance.
And Eric?
I would say the same. I'm definitely on the internet. www.burklaw.com is the firm's website. You can find my profile. You can also find me on LinkedIn and send me a message that way. You know, my contact information is out there, and we're always happy to meet new folks and see if we can help.
Thank you.
Terrific conversation. You could have kept going because I was hanging on to everything. That was great. And I have to say, just to drive the point home, between this conversation and your conversation with George Kay, there is a wealth of information and things that need to be considered. It's worth taking a listen to it and giving it some serious thought if you're thinking about selling your business. Nicole, we know how to get a hold of everybody else, but we know how to get a hold of you.
Sure.
How do we reach out to you?
I'm going to say the same thing. You can go to our website at myprivatevista.com. And on our homepage, there's a contact us button, and you can just put your information there. Please reference this episode. And then I'm happy to talk to any of our listeners or get them in touch with one of my wonderful colleagues.
Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Nicole. Everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks, Nicole.
You guys. We appreciate you being here today.
Yeah,
and
thank
listeners,
you.
We appreciate you for listening to this podcast. If you are not already a subscriber, hit the subscribe button. It's easy, it's simple, and this way you will never miss another episode of this podcast because it will be delivered to you right where you listen when it's released. If you like it, we would humbly ask that you maybe rate it and share it with other people. Spread the word about the podcast. In the meantime, for all the people at Private Vista, I'm Bill Tucker, urging you to go out and live your best life today. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Dollars and Cents, Creating Your Fulfilled Life with Nicole Romito, sponsored by Private Vista. Visit our website at www.myprivatevista.com or give us a call at 312-831-4370. And don't forget to click the follow button to be notified when new episodes become available. Private Vista is a group comprised of investment professionals registered with Hightower Advisors, LLC,
an SEC-registered investment advisor. Advisory services are offered through Hightower Advisors, LLC. This is not an offer to buy or sell securities. No investment process is free of risk, and there is no guarantee that the investment process or the investment opportunities referenced herein will be profitable. Past performance is neither indicative nor a guarantee of future results. The investment opportunities referenced herein may not be suitable for all investors. All data or other information referenced herein is from sources believed to be reliable. Any opinions, news, research, analyses, prices, or other data or information contained in this presentation is provided as general market commentary and does not constitute investment advice. Private Vista and Hightower Advisors, LLC, or any of its affiliates make no representations or warranties expressed or implied as to the accuracy or completeness of the information or for statements or errors or omissions, or results obtained from the use of this information. Private Vista and Hightower Advisors, LLC assume no liability for action made or taken in reliance on or relating in any way to this information. The information is provided as of the date referenced. Such data and other information are subject to changes without notice. This was created for informational purposes only. The opinions expressed herein are solely those of the authors and do not represent those of Hightower Advisors, LLC, or any of its affiliates.